You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Despite a growing sense of economic uncertainty, many Wall Street firms are handing out record-breaking bonuses. Where is this leading? Well, Bruce Judson, a senior faculty fellow at the Yale School of Management, believes it's possible the growing disparity could actually boil over into violence. His new book, It Could Happen Here, is published by HarperCollins, and I'm very pleased that it has brought him to our show today. Hello.
Hi.
The first chapter of your book is a series of newspaper and magazine articles. Why did you choose that format?
I thought it was important to try and give a sense of how do you make this reality. The book is about growing economic inequality. And at this moment, we are at the highest levels since we have recorded data. In the history of the Republic, we have never been as divided as we are now.
Even in the early days when we had things like the Whiskey Rebellion?
As far as we know. We only have good data since we started the income tax, which was early 1900s. But as far as we know, yes, in fact, from the Whiskey Rebellion. But since around 1915 through to today, we are at the absolute highest levels.
And that includes during the Depression?
It includes during the Depression, and that is interesting. Because if you look at inequality throughout the past 95 years, it looks like a U. 1928 was a high point. And then 2007 was the next high point, 2006, 2007, which passed. So what you see is that is the ultimate question is it a coincidence that 1928, when we had extraordinary inequality, was followed by 1929, and 2007 was followed by 2008?
And the articles that you reprint here are from the New York Times and other major newspapers and magazines because you want to make it clear that you're trying to do something that's credible.
That's correct.
The articles have two subjects, a growing economic disparity and the ease of acquiring nuclear material, and you're obviously making a link between the two, but does that mean that they're linked in the minds of somebody who's disaffected?
No, it doesn't. But it doesn't mean it's impossible. What I wanted to show was that the second chapter, following this first chapter in news articles, is a fictional chapter about what happens, and there are American terrorists who've used, they've taken the things that happened in the first chapter and then act on them. And what I wanted to show was that we tend to think that after an attack on America, after 9/11, after Pearl Harbor, people will rally around the government. In this scenario, we have American terrorists who say, I am so upset with the inequality in society. I am so upset by this disparity that I'm holding the nation for ransom. And it becomes a divided nation. You don't see people rally.
And I will come back to that.
Okay.
But I just want to lay the groundwork a bit more. Can't the rich get richer without the poor getting poorer?
We have not seen it.
Because we've had an expanding economy, haven't we?
Two-thirds of the growth of the economy between 2002 and 2007 all went to the top 1% of Americans.
So my sense that until the recent meltdown, the general public enjoyed a growing prosperity in this country and has for the past few decades, that's not true?
That was a false prosperity built on excess debt, and those loans are coming due with a fury.
On the other hand, there have always been cycles, and I remember any number of other economic downturns that suggested the end of American prosperity, and then we bounce back.
You are absolutely right. And, you know, there's a notion that we're a self-correcting democracy, and I hope that we do self-correct. That's what everyone anticipates. But you can reach a point where you don't. And that's the question the book raises.
One of the reasons given for the growing gap is the decrease in union membership over the years. Now, first of all, why is that? If people are concerned about a growing gap, why wouldn't they be joining unions instead of leaving unions?
I think that I'm not going to say that I'm a fan or not a fan of unions. There were lots of issues around unions, but what I think is important is that in the, we'll call it 1960s, the typical head of a company made about 40 times the lowest paid worker. Today, that number, CEO to lowest paid worker, is around 300. All right. So when in the 1960s, a CEO would have been embarrassed to make 300 times what the lowest paid worker made.
Today, and the union would have been screaming his head off, too.
Correct. Today, a CEO is embarrassed if he's not. Mm. Okay. So the way I look at it is there has been a dramatic change in the way that pie is split. And unions played a central role in ensuring in the way the pie was split. With the disappearance of unions, we've had a split up toward the top and toward the bottom, in part with unions. There are a number of other factors as well.
Now, the trickle-down theory has been generally disproved, at least it didn't work the way we were told it would. But hasn't there been some of that anyway in New York, for example, when Wall Street is booming, New York City's economy is booming, and now Wall Street is bouncing back, and I would assume that the city is going to be doing well again.
That is always true because you become dependent on those people who are spending money. It distorts your economy. I mean, one of the things that I think happens historically, one of the reasons that economic inequality is such a predictor of political instability is that wealth and power go together. And the wealthy start to do things that distort the economy in all kinds of ways.
Several of the articles refer to a new social profile, the former middle class.
Yes.
Who are they and why are they significant to your story?
They're very significant because ultimately political stability depends on a strong middle class. That is the key. If we have a strong middle class, we will do fine. If our middle class disappears, we have a problem. Okay. And what we are seeing right now is that the middle class is in real trouble.
But people in the middle class may go through economic difficulties, but they still see themselves as middle class. In fact, I think more Americans have defined themselves as middle class than people in any other country in the world.
That's right. But let's think about what it means, what we've defined as middle class in the past and what we may be defining it as in the future. I think of middle class as people who believe they are or have the potential to live the American dream in some way. And we can define the American. It's hard to define who's middle class, easy to define the American dream. So the American dream is home ownership, a secure job of some kind, a pension or decent retirement, access to health care, the ability to send the kids to college, and hopefully upward mobility. And those things are all under assault.
My guess is Bruce Judson of Yale, his book It Could Happen Here, America on the Brink, published by HarperCollins. Well, why haven't these economic circumstances created a political movement? These are Ralph Nader's issues, and yet many people were furious when he announced that he was running for president the last time. In fact, and the previous time as well.
I believe they did create a political movement, and it was the election of Barack Obama. People looked to him and still look to him for reform. They look to him for change. And one of the central issues, I think, at this moment is people are still waiting to see, will he do something, or this administration, that brings a return to jobs? Will they do something for me as a homeowner? We are on track for 13 million foreclosures, one in every four homeowners. People are still hopeful that this is what they elected him for.
Well, are the poor actually poorer or relatively poorer? For example, it's been pointed out that the poor in this country live better than the middle class in many other countries.
That's absolutely right. And it's an interesting concept. But when you look back at history, it's not the question of how poor you are, but relatively how you are doing relative to everyone else and whether you believe it's fair. And fair is a central question here. Americans have always admired the rich. They still do. But the kind of rich they admire are Michael Dell, Jeff Bezos, people who have created something. What we've seen in the past decade or so is a massive redistribution of wealth. John McCain talked about redistributor-in-chief, but it was going the other way. And it went upward, and a lot of it went toward financial activity that did not create wealth. It is, in my view, a real failure of capitalism that the highest paid people in the society are traders. It should be the people who create value. So now people are asking, is this fair?
Well, they're also asking, is it fair because many of the CEOs of corporations who've been paid millions and millions of dollars have not really done a good job?
Yes, they are. And many people say...
But that disaffection does not... I've never heard anybody say, well, I'm so upset about this, I'm going to go out and create a dirty bomb and kill a lot of people.
What happens if, in fact, we do foreclose on one in every four mortgages? Okay. Do we believe that this will still be the America that we grew up in?
Haven't we already seen that in Detroit and some other places?
If we saw the rest of the country look like Detroit, I'm not sure what our political system would look like.
Okay. So the next question is, how difficult would it be for someone who's disaffected to make a dirty bomb?
That is actually easy, from what I understand.
Well, we don't have the kinds of camps that we've seen in Pakistan where members of the former American middle class are training to become terrorists.
I think if the question is, if you're asking, I think there are two separate questions. One is, does inequality make you more vulnerable to terrorism of this kind? And the answer is absolutely yes. Anytime you're a less divided society, you are more vulnerable.
But haven't most of the jihadists been from the upper middle class?
Yes, okay. The second question I think you're asking is, could a laid-off medical nuclear engineer create a dirty bomb? Absolutely. In fact, as you may know, I was on Point, which is distributed nationwide by NPR, and a laid-off nuclear engineer called in and said, I'm not going to tell you how to make a nuclear bomb, but it's easy. That's really not the point here. It could have been, if you look at the Soviet Union, which collapsed for all kinds of other reasons, my point was much more to illustrate there that that as a divided nation, we're vulnerable and that these things do happen.
We already have powerful and motivated enemies, never mind our own former middle class. Mm-hmm. If it's so easy to do, why hasn't anyone done it yet? I think it's just the sort of thing that we'd expect Osama bin Laden would want to bankroll.
I think that one of the articles that I cited at the beginning of the book says that experts believe within a certain period of time there's a 50% chance we will see a dirty bomb go off in the United States. I don't remember whether it was 10 or 20 years.
We just can hope that it's not in a plane over Detroit with the system working.
Most experts are surprised or certainly believe there's at least a 50-50 chance that we will see that happen at some point in the near future.
But that doesn't mean anything. We've had all sorts of predictions in the past.
Correct.
That have never turned out to be true. And we never had nuclear war with the Soviet Union. In fact, who would have predicted the Soviet Union would just fall apart?
That's exactly my point. We were spending, I think it was $30 billion a year to watch the Soviet Union, and no one anticipated that it would collapse.
My guest is Bruce Judson, who's a senior faculty fellow at the Yale School of Management, also an entrepreneur and a lawyer, and the author of It Could Happen Here, America on the Brink. It's published by Harper. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. We're back with Bruce Judson, a senior faculty fellow at the Yale School of Management, author of Go It Alone and Net Marketing, and also the co-author of Hyper Wars, and Now It Could Happen Here, America on the Brink, published by Harper. And I mentioned earlier you're also an entrepreneur. Is this book an argument against your own class?
No, I hope it's not. Because if my class is the entrepreneurial class, if that's
well, you've also I gather you did quite well when you hedged against the market crash.
Yes, in the summer of 2007, I started this book in 2006 when people thought that these ideas were irrelevant. People said to me, "No one is interested in class. Why is HarperCollins publishing this?" And people, literally, is this a thought experiment? And I said, no, historically, as you move towards extraordinary economic inequality, societies start to get out of balance and economies get out of balance. And in the summer of 2007, I became deeply depressed as I was researching the book. And in part, I make my living running certain businesses, doing some consulting, and I believed strongly that if what I thought was going to happen happened, that we would have a hard time making a living. So I did hedge against the crash, and yes, HarperCollins put it in the book because they wanted people to know, I guess, that I had some ability to see what was going to happen. But I would not. I don't see that as part of my class. I see that at that was almost like insurance. Entrepreneurs, in my mind, create value. They are what make. They are an example of American ingenuity and innovation.
But the entrepreneurs of the past, because this book mm-hmm. is also about history, mm-hmm. in the 19th century, the robber barons were the great entrepreneurs. And I don't know what the statistics reveal, but my sense of that time is that there was an incredible gap between the rich and the poor then,
absolutely right.
Especially since so many of the people who were coming here were immigrants and could barely eke out a living.
Absolutely right. And,
but we didn't have a revolution.
Teddy Roosevelt came in and we had antitrust laws. And I would love to see, and I think at this moment, one of the central criticisms of this administration is that we are not making use of our antitrust laws. When I look at
this administration any administration over the past 25, 30 years?
This administration simply because we are in a reform era. Hmm. You know, as an example, I do not believe that the federal government should be in the business of regulating salaries and financial institutions. But nobody, in my mind, is asking the question, why are financial institutions able to continuously make such extraordinary profits? That has to be monopoly profits. And why are antitrust laws not being put to use here? The same in part, and I think, in the healthcare debate.
Actually, as a listener points out, there were people who were exploding bombs between the 1880s and the 1920s. Mm-hmm. We did have the Sacco and Vanzetti case, for example. We had the Haymarket. We had a whole bunch of things. It is true. But nobody ever got that the anarchist movement was kind of imported from Europe, wasn't it?
Yeah. Well, the real place to look, I think, is the farmers during the Depression. Because they really, you started to see, farmers are naturally conservative people. And they said, and people said that, testifying before Congress. And they said, these people... Farm Belt is about to erupt. Roosevelt was told it was about to. You did see violence. And they were saying, this is not the America that I grew up in. This is not the America I believe in. And that's the ultimate question here, is do we pass some point where we are no longer the nation that people anticipate?
Haven't most of the people who've talked that way in recent years been on the far right? And there have been... any number of organizations that have been engaged in some kind of quasi-terrorist activity. Timothy McVeigh becomes the most obvious example.
My read in this, looking back over time, is that once you hit kind of extraordinary economic inequality, you become vulnerable either from the left or the right.
The Turner Diaries were all about the right suddenly mm-hmm. taking over and killing all the people on the left.
People tend to think, I am not saying that it could be left or right. All I'm saying is that we are vulnerable.
Well, in your book, the chapter that is a work of fiction, you wind up with these terrorists winding up with a dirty bomb and blackmailing America. And you imagine states seceding from the Union, immediately granting these middle-class terrorist demands, universal health care, free tuition to state universities, an end to foreclosures. Sounds like the sort of thing that members of the liberal wing of the Democratic Party had hoped that an Obama administration would bring. But many people have resisted any changes because it would mean putting the nation into even greater debt than we're in right now.
Are we talking now? Are you asking about financial
reform? The state that is the first one to secede in your scenario is Florida.
Okay.
Now, where would they come up with the money to fund an health care plan when we can't come up with it on a national level. And I wondered about Florida, especially because its demographic is skewed toward the elderly, which would make it especially difficult and put it under a particularly heavy financial burden.
I think there are two things going on here. The first is my point in that fictional scenario is the fundamental role of the government, first and foremost responsibility, is to keep people safe. And when the government failed in that job, it was a Hobbesian choice. Imagine that you are the governor of Florida and you are looking at the president and he's saying, there's nothing I can do.
And but who's the governor of Florida, Charlie Crist?
I don't know what any governor would do at this moment confronted with that reality. But there is a second one, which is that we've not laid out, in my view, at this moment, we are way too accepting of the unacceptable. Larry Summers said that 10% unemployment is unacceptable. When President Obama was a candidate, he said 5% unemployment was a crisis. Right now, we are accepting of double that level. And it seems so. I guess what I'm in part saying is that I think we, too self-correct, and in general, are a much better nation than we are acting. We do not see the administration saying we are moving toward, I want 3% unemployment. We are going to get there. And you look at ingenuity. You look at what happened in the New Deal. We invented the FDIC. We invented Social Security. The bank failures had been the scourge of history. FDIC, the 30-year mortgage, was invented to keep people in their homes. We have not seen here, everyone talks to me about ingenuity. We have not seen in this crisis ingenuity and openness to experimentation.
And isn't one of the reasons that we have so much polarization right now, where if I suggested that somebody turn 2 degrees, there would be 25 people arguing that 2 degrees is too much,
right,
too radical?
And I believe two things relative to that. One is one of the problems of economic inequality is it leads to polarization, because once you have people at the very top and people at the very bottom, the impact of different policies is so great that you become dysfunctional. The other is that I believe it is the job of great leaders to do two things. To say, here's a vision that is will take you beyond what you can think you can accomplish. We can do more. John Kennedy said we're going to go to the moon, and take you outside of yourself. We have become a nation where people are worried about themselves, as opposed to a nation where people are worried about the larger society.
My guest is Bruce Judson, senior faculty fellow at the Yale School of Management. His latest book, It Could Happen Here, America on the Brink, published by Harper. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. In one of your chapters, you ask whether we're immune from history. How would you historically define a revolution, and would it always involve violence?
No, it does not always involve violence. I broadly define a revolution to mean a change in the form of government, which is not anticipated by that form of government. In a sense, the Constitution has a built-in self-correcting mechanism, which is the amendment process or a constitutional convention, which can be called. If you had something else, that is what I broadly define as a revolution. So within that definition, the collapse of the Soviet Union, which was unanticipated by anyone. At one moment, Ronald Reagan said it was an evil empire. The next moment, it had disappeared. That was a kind of revolution.
Although now we're seeing fairly stable government, despite the fact that there's a growing economic gap in Russia today. So I don't know whether maybe that it doesn't seem to bother people. There are people who argue that the only time you have a revolution is when all of the restrictions, the repression, is eased up a bit.
One of the things I do believe and talk about and looked hard at is that revolutions happen in periods of reform, which is what you're talking mm-hmm. about. People, you have a suffering people, and then you have someone say, I'm going to make things better. And their expectations for a better period, their expectations are raised, and then for some reason it doesn't happen. That's the danger today. That's what happened in the Soviet Union. It's what happened in the revolution in France.
In this country, we have had Alexis de Tocqueville
yes.
telling us that it's unlikely that we would ever have a revolution, and we've believed it ever since.
Yes, and as I think you know, that I quote that in the book, but Alexis de Tocqueville said that because he, for two reasons. He said that we had a strong middle class. When de Tocqueville visited America in the 1820s, he said that America was essentially what he called a nation of an equal nation. We had a few rich people, a few poor people, but we were a middle-class nation, and that was what would make us a great democracy. And he was right about that. The other thing he said was that we Americans acted in what he called self-interest well understood, which does not mean we were unselfish. It means that people did things in their own interest, but they, what they did, they also knew was good for the larger nation, the society. And I think one of the things that's happened, one of the things that certainly happened in the financial sector, is we came to believe that if it was legal, it was good or it was okay. And that's simply not true.
What did Will and Ariel Durant, a couple who were really big when I was a kid,
right.
largely forgotten today, what did they say in their book, The Lessons of History,
right.
about the predictable cycle of economics and its effect on history?
Well, as you know, after they had written hundreds or thousands of pages and looked at history from the Romans forward.
The history of philosophy. They
right.
kind of condensed all the world philosophy.
Right, everything. They wrote a very short book. It was about a little over 100 pages on the lessons of history. And they said in that book, you know, it is very, very difficult to abstract lessons, and people try too often to generalize. They had a chapter, I think it was about 7 pages on economics, and 4 of them were on concentration of wealth. 4 of those pages. And what they said was that the long cycle of history is that wealth concentrates and then is redistributed. And it's either redistributed peacefully or through violence. But that is the natural cycle.
So here we are. We have this growing disparity, a big gap between the rich and the poor. We see this in other parts of the world. We mm-hmm. see this in Mexico, for example. Mm-hmm. No revolution in Mexico. Yeah, you just held up your finger.
There are people who have questions about what's going on in Mexico or what will happen. But I think a better statement is, would we want – America is not Mexico. If America started to look like Mexico, I think the founding fathers would say we had failed.
Well, is there a difference between – realizing that you can't be a two-car household and have a country home and not being able to feed or school your children?
There is in the sense of expectations. Okay, I, one of the things I like to say, I think about is when you and I were growing up, I suspect, it was possible to have a one-earner household, not doing, you know, and own a home, send the kids to college, and maybe take a decent vacation. You could have a lifestyle. Today, that requires 2 incomes at least, on the one hand. On the other hand, and this is where I think you hit this issue of expectations and relative deprivation. You look up and say, what are these people who are making $1 billion a year doing? And how is it helping the society? I am happy, or I celebrate people. I'll use Jeff Bezos for what he has done to create a more efficient or more to create value for our nation. But what have all of these people?
Will he ever be forgiven for the Kindle?
depends who you are as to whether you think it's a positive or a negative. But the better question is, people are looking and saying, literally, I thought gambling was illegal. You know, investment banks it's an interesting name, investment. You used to read that investment banks invested in things. Now you read they bet in things. I never see the word invest. I see bet. And I kind of look and go, I thought gambling was illegal. It's to me, it's that simple. Mm-hmm. It's not laying off risk. If it was reducing risk, that would be one thing.
Well, the part of the problem is that for the rest of us, we were told that if we bought a house and we paid we knew somebody who bought a house at $20,000, it was now worth $1.5 million.
Right.
And that this was just going to keep on going
yes.
and going and going.
Yes. That is a real problem of people who I'm not quite sure what you're
well,
asking.
Well, the whole thing is that we all believe that for the last 30 years or so, mm-hmm. and then suddenly we're faced with the fact that, except in New York, where property values continue to be way too high, people who had homes that were worth $1.5 million last year now find themselves with a home worth half that price.
Right. It is possible that we are still in what I call in the book the delusion phase as opposed to acceptance or non-acceptance.
So we're in a state of denial still.
We may still be. The latest polls I saw said that people believed their homes would appreciate at 11% a year, which seems highly unlikely. There were polls that showed at the height of the housing crisis, I believe 50% of people thought their house had not lost value, when in fact 75% of all homes had lost value.
Well, okay, so we come to pretty much the end of this conversation, and the answer you seem to be suggesting is wealth redistribution, which I see is almost an impossible thing to pull off in this country.
I am not suggesting wealth redistribution because I believe that is failure. That is saying that our economy does not work and we must redistribute afterwards. What I think we need is to say, how do we set up our economy so that we do not have monopolies, so that we return to an era where people are paid appropriately.
In Scandinavia, aren't there some countries that have laws that don't allow the heads of corporations to make more than a certain percentage of what everybody else makes?
Corporate pay and corporate governance are extraordinarily difficult topics, just as what are good middle class jobs. So do I have an answer for that? No, I don't.
Well, what kinds of laws would you like to see enacted?
Okay. Well, I think there are two or three things that I would like to see. First, I would really love to see the president stand up and say, I am committing myself to 2% unemployment, and everything I do from now and to keeping people in their homes, and everything I do is going to be oriented toward that. Because right now—
And then people are going to start screaming, he's a socialist, which they already scream anyway.
They're already screaming anyway. And then when he put forward a jobs bill, people would not be saying it would have a vision around it. It would be for a purpose. Mm-hmm. The same with something related to housing. There are many things we could be doing related to keeping people in their homes. And the way to break through, I think, polarization maybe is the articulation of a goal and a vision. They've talked about this president as having lots of deadlines, but what we've not heard is the Kennedy kind of, we will send a man to the moon by the end of the decade. We've not heard, I commit myself to unemployment. That's one. Second, I'm
Well, by the way, I have to point out that after World War II, the Democrats committed themselves to eliminating, to 100% employment. It mm-hmm. never happened.
But I do believe at this moment, 30% of American families have someone that has lost their job. Someone that has lost a job. I think that if the president stood up and said, as FDR stood up at his inauguration, said, the people want action and action now, and he just kept experimenting and trying things until he found things that worked. I do believe that if the administration today said, we are committing ourselves to this, and here are the first steps, if they don't work, we're going to take the next steps, that we would move through that polarization because it would have a vision. The other thing I'm on record as saying is I do not believe we should have taken Glass-Steagall away. We should have. It worked. It's very rare for us to have had regulations that worked. And now we've had a failure. Why are we not bringing it back?
It's interesting that many people have said we should bring it back, and yet nobody seems to propose it in Congress.
It is even more interesting that you sometimes see in the press that only the left wing believes we should bring it back. I've not seen many mainstream economists that support the current regulation. I think that it's terrific. The administration has set this policy, and many people believe it's Wall Street driven. That's the answer, I think.
Bruce Judson is a senior faculty fellow at Yale School of Management. His book is called It Could Happen Here: America on the Brink, published by Harper's. Thank you so much for being with us today.
It's a pleasure.